Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Tuesday, July 21st, welcome, 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 friends, on Into the Program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arend.
How old is too old to run the country? It's a question Americans keep asking every election cycle, but lately it's become impossible to ignore. President Donald Trump is the oldest person ever to assume the presidency. Congress is one of the oldest in our nation's history. We have more than two dozen members over the age of 80, and many are seeking re-election. We have five members of Congress who have died in office since 2025. And earlier this month, you recall Senator Lindsey Graham died suddenly at the age of 71. So, and if we zoom out, there's even more questions because we've seen other lawmakers disappear from public view for weeks or months with little word about the nature of their illness, leaving constituents wondering who is representing them. So today, we're looking at whether it is time for age limits in Congress. We're also looking at what type of transparency our elected officials owe us when their health impacts their ability to do their jobs. And so we've got a great group of folks coming on the show today, including a former staffer for Senator John Fetterman. So we'd love to hear from you. Should there be an age limit for elected officials? If so, where would you cap it? And then later in the show, we'll ask, should elected officials have to disclose medical issues that interfere with their jobs? You can give us a call. The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, you can leave your comments in the live chat. And we already are getting comments on Facebook. People are going all over the place when we talk about this. And it can be a very sensitive subject
for a lot of folks. Understandably so. Yeah. So bring that energy to the phone lines, 888-477-9499. But first, a trio of local news stories, starting with a post-conviction mess in the DA's office here in Philadelphia. There are new accusations that suggest Philadelphia District Attorney Larry Krasner and his office mishandled a post-conviction murder case and then tried to cover up that misconduct. Just yesterday, two prosecutors in the DA's office say Krasner instructed them to act unethically in the case of a man named Dennis Johnson, who is seeking to have a murder conviction overturned. That's according to a Philadelphia Inquirer review of a recent court filing. We have to rewind for a second. This is sort of a complicated story.
It is, yeah.
So back in 2022, a prosecutor named Jacqueline Mason recommended that this murder conviction of the man Dennis Johnson be overturned. It later came to light that the brief she wrote accompanying this recommendation had some major red flags in it. So then Mason testified that she was basically pressured by her supervisor, a man named Matthew Stiegler, to make this recommendation and write this brief. She said the prosecutor's office colluded with defense attorneys, basically looking for ways to get this conviction overturned instead of actually doing an independent investigation of the facts. Now, that brings us to the latest revelation. Two more attorneys in the DA's office say they wanted to recommend that this case, because of all the potential issues we're talking about here, be moved to the state attorney general's office, saying, look, the Philly DA should not be part of this process anymore. Too many red flags. And these attorneys say Krasner then rebuffed their requests and told them to, quote, protect the office. Okay, so there's a lot to sift through here, but basically you now have three prosecutors claiming the DA's office is really not playing by the book in this post-conviction murder appeal. Krasner says he has a lot to say, but he can't say it right now because there is a pending federal case about this whole matter.
Well, we've had DA Larry Krasner on the show before, and at some point, I hope he comes on again because there's a lot of explaining to do. These allegations must be taken seriously. As a reporter, I covered the conviction integrity unit at this DA's office for years. I know how hard it is to get a case overturned, but credibility, Avi, credibility of all parties involved is so important. The judge has to be able to trust the prosecutors and the defense attorneys, and they are making critical decisions. And hearing these prosecutors say this about a member of the bar and the DA's office and the supervisors will give the bench pause.
Absolutely.
It will give the bench pause, and it's a trust issue. And to me, that will make it even harder for people who have suffered injustice, right? who have been waiting and waiting and waiting and hoping to get a judge to look at their case, it's going to make it harder for them
because there's
going to be even more scrutiny. Yeah.
And what's fascinating about all this is it's sort of like the photo negative of an argument that Larry Krasner himself was making for years, mm-hmm. and justifiably so, saying that prosecutors would collude with detectives and police.
Yeah.
To get a conviction at all cost, and mm-hmm. maybe ignore the facts to get a conviction. And now the accusation is boomeranging back around. The DA's office is ignoring the facts.
And colluding with the defense attorneys.
To get a conviction overturned, right? And so you don't want either of those things to happen in the justice system. So we'll keep our eye on that story. Story number two, Cherry.
Story number two. Some Pennsylvania state colleges are considering whether it's time to offer 3-year bachelor degrees. The Pennsylvania State System of Higher Education, or PASHE, they're trying to decide whether to join other colleges across the country. They're offering so-called accelerated bachelor degrees. These programs reduce the number of credits that one needs to graduate from 120 credits to anywhere from 90 to 100 credits. And, you know, there's no secret. Colleges are facing declining enrollment, including in Pennsylvania, where PASHE schools have seen a 30% enrollment decline since 2010, although recently they had a bit of a bump on enrollment. Mm-hmm. But supporters of these accelerated degrees say the focus is on the essence of what students need to know in a specific area and shorter time. You know, it saves time, it saves money. And critics say this is a stripped down method that threatens academic integrity and intellectual development in favor of speed.
Right, because they're saying if you can get it done in 3 years, a college might be able to entice someone to enroll because you would spend less money getting that degree.
Less money and you get it done quicker.
Get into the workforce quicker, yeah.
Either way, I think, you know, this is happening. The Higher Learning Commission, the nation's largest accrediting body, they've already approved 58 reduced credit BAs at more than 24 institutions across the country thus far. None of those are in Pennsylvania or New Jersey because the commission that approves our accreditation doesn't really need to approve this.
Okay.
But PASHE wants it approved by the state. And so this is going to be on the agenda this fall. And there are hundreds of schools across the country that are considering accelerated degrees because this new generation, they're rejecting the idea of spending thousands and thousands of dollars going into debt for a BA. They're not doing it. And so, you know, these colleges and institutions, higher ed says we have to adjust or we'll end up closing.
Yeah, the Inquirer did a nice deep dive on this on this whole topic. It's fascinating. It's been percolating for a while, the idea of a 3-year degree, but really it's gained more traction mm-hmm. recently. And this is the latest example. Look, 4 years.
It's a long time.
But it's also kind of arbitrary, right? Yeah, the idea of the 4-year bachelor goes back many hundreds of years mm-hmm. in this country. And a lot of people who get a 4-year degree actually take 5, 6, 7 years to do it. So all of this, the time scaling is arbitrary to begin with. Of course, you still have to study whether the people who get a degree in 3 years prosper like the people who get it in 4 years. What's the trade-off being made here? You should study outcomes, I think, as well, not just assume you can do it quicker.
And they've been doing it with accelerated master's degrees for a while. They've been reducing the time. But I will say there were some classes in there. I mean, you and I, we went to college. You know, they could have shaved off a couple of those classes. Like, it was not necessary. I'm just going to put that out there.
But it's hard to know exactly which ones to shave for which people. Because people find different value in different things. Facts. Sometimes the courses you're forced to take end up being really life-changing, right? So I think it's difficult, but I do think it should be studyable. And we should be able to figure out whether this is a product that should be made available to more students.
More people. We'll see.
Okay, mm-hmm. third story, and an important one, of course.
Yes.
We always save the important ones for last.
Go right ahead.
So you may remember the case of Phillies Karen, a mm-hmm. woman at a Phillies Marlins game who basically took a home run ball away from a kid and his dad. Folks, I hate to report this, but we have yet another Phillies ball controversy caught in 4K at last night's game. Let's set it up. The Phillies hit a home run. The ball flies into the stands. Let's roll the video here. A guy in a Phillies jersey tries to catch the ball with his hat. The ball lands in his hat with such force that the hat and ball come flying out of his hand. They then land in the hands of a guy a couple rows back in an mm-hmm. Eagles jersey. You following me so far?
I'm following.
Okay. So the original guy, the hat guy, goes up to the guy who eventually got the ball, the jersey guy, the Eagles jersey guy, and demands the ball back from him, and the Eagles jersey guy gives the ball to him.
So that was a Phillies Darren then.
Exactly. Mm. I was wondering, what is a male Karen?
We're going to call him a Darren.
I like that.
Mm-hmm.
Phillies Darren here gets the ball back, even though he did not secure the ball in the end.
So, Avi, I don't go to games. I don't know the rules of, you know, fly balls or whatever. So break down the rule. Tell me how it's supposed to go down.
In my opinion, the unwritten rule is if you didn't catch it, you didn't catch it. So you tried to catch it. It landed in your hat. You did not secure the catch. You did not secure the ball. So it went to someone else and that person gets to keep the ball. I was shocked that the guy gave the ball back to the, what, why did the, why does
why'd your, you cave, man?
Yeah, why? Well,
you should have been too intense. To be fair,
we don't know what Phillies Darren said to him. He did look angry.
He was kind of thick, you know. He had shoulders.
I might have made the same. That might have been a business decision. I feel like at the end of the day, if you get the ball, as long as you didn't push someone down or harm someone, you should.
He had strong shoulders.
You should be able to keep the ball. I just don't get what the Phillies Darren was thinking here.
Yeah.
And I think it's unfortunate that he ended up with the ball.
Yeah. This is Studio 2.
Follow the ball. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Today's U.S. Congress is one of the oldest in history. 24 U.S. senators and representatives are over the age of 80. And the recent news, like Senator Mitch McConnell being hospitalized, have sparked renewed debate about how we age and health and how health affects our elected leaders.
So today on the show, we're diving into the debate around age limits for politicians. Should there be a cap on how old your senator, representative, or president can be? There are already some state laws on the books concerning age. Judges in Pennsylvania, for instance, have to retire by 75. So should this apply to more officials?
Joining us today is Maya Kornberg, senior fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU Law and the author of Stuck, How Money, Media, and Violence Prevent Change in Congress. Maya, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you so much for having me.
Also with us is Dr. Tracy Gendron, chair of the Virginia Commonwealth University Department of Gerontology and executive director at the Virginia Center on Aging. Tracy, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
And for you, our listeners at home, on the road, or elsewhere, our question of the day: should there be an age limit for elected officials, and where would you cap it? You can give us a call, 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org.
Let me read this comment from Bob in Malvern just to start off the show. Bob says, this is a timely topic for me. I just finished the book Original Sin by Jake Tapper and Alex Thompson about President Biden's decline and the cover-up. I was both horrified and infuriated by the events described in the book, and now I see more of the same coming out of Donald Trump's administration. Because of this, I feel we need to amend the Constitution to establish a maximum age limit for the president, members of Congress, and federal judges. I feel that for both the president and members of Congress, an individual cannot assume office, either first term or re-election, if they are over 69 years of age. That's what Bob in Malvern has to say. So I'm going to put it to both of our guests, Maya and Tracy, and I want you to lay out, A, whether you think there should be age limits for serving in Congress, in a federal judiciary role, or president, and what you think that age limit should be, and of course your reasoning. I'll start with you, Maya Kornberg.
So I certainly and wholeheartedly think that we need a maximum age limit for the presidency, for Congress, and for the judiciary. And, you know, I'm a congressional scholar. You know, for Congress, no one is arguing that there shouldn't be a minimum age. The Constitution does set out minimum ages for the House, for the Senate, and for the presidency. And so I do think that we need to be thinking about a maximum age, especially since the Constitution was written when human longevity was just not what it is now. Mm-hmm. And we need to account for cognitive issues and health issues, increasingly making it so that older members are unfit to serve. And we need to account for a mounting gerontocracy problem that I think is very much related to what we're seeing, which is also mass disengagement on the part of young people. and a feeling that government does not represent them. So with that in mind, I have argued for what I think is actually a pretty conservative age, upper age limit for Congress, which is 80. Mm-hmm. I know Rahm Emanuel and others have argued for 75. I think that could make sense as well. But I think the important thing is to be having the conversation and to be pushing towards towards an age limit.
So Dr. Tracy Gentrin, I would love to hear from you. Do you think there should be an age limit for elected office holders at the federal level, for federal judges? Why or why not?
So not surprisingly, I very strongly disagree with Maya, respectfully. I think that voters are right to care about fitness for office. I don't debate that. I think chronological age by itself is just not a valid assessment of fitness. So age and ability are not interchangeable. Some abilities change with age while others remain stable. Some even peak in later life, and people vary enormously. Development in early life cannot mimic development in later life, right? They are simply not the same. We don't develop our brain capacity until our late 20s, but there's no such parallel in later life. It's too heterogeneous. There's too much heterogeneity and too much individuation. So what we should be assessing is actual capacity, judgment, ethics, knowledge, performance, but we can't use birthday as a diagnosis. If we do that, then we're actually potentially eliminating some very qualified people from the potential pool. So the idea of gerontocracy, that's a whole other question. We can ask whether government is demographically representative, but that's very different from asking whether a particular person is capable.
And Dr. Gendron, I'd love to follow up with you on this question. I mean, we have pilots, we have air traffic controllers, many judges here in Pennsylvania, retirement age is 75, military officers. There are many professions that have mandatory retirement ages. So can you make an argument outside of just, you know, 80, you know, 80 is different, or the age or the chronological number is different for different people? Why should lawmakers be different than other professions that require mental acuity and fitness and have put an age cap?
Yeah, so job standards should be specific to the job. And commercial aviation is a great example. They use standardized training, they use recurrent evaluation, they use medical certification and clearly defined operational tasks. Political leadership is multidimensional. Mm-hmm. It includes judgment, deliberation, representation, electoral accountability. So the comparison that you're giving actually supports job-specific assessment, not a universal age rule, right? So greater consequences require more valid and comprehensive evaluation, but not a precise age shortcut.
Do you think there could be... Yeah. Theoretically, a competency test that you could apply fairly to, let's just say, members of Congress. Let's put judges aside for a second. To members of Congress that could say, look, if you fail this test, maybe you fail it twice, three times, whatever, you're just not fit for office anymore. Or do you think such a test does not exist for a job that is, as you say, multi-dimensional as serving in Congress? Dr. Gendron.
It's a very slippery slope because cognitive and functional abilities related to this kind of job are really hard to measure. And then you would have to ask yourself, who's designing this test? Right. Is it measuring what it's supposed to measure? Could it be misused in any way for political gain? But I think the standard for capacity for the job should be equally applied to everyone. We also need to recognize that we can have changes to our brain and cognition at any age. Sleep deprivation, substance use, traumatic brain injury. These are things that happen all throughout the lifespan, not just to people that are older. So perhaps if we're talking about competency, we just need to look at it across the board.
Brian comments and says the age limit should be 75, with the definition being that their 75th birthday cannot be prior to the election date for the office they are running for. This should be across all levels of government, federal, state, and local. This should also apply to justices at all level. No more of this until death do us part. If you want to add your thoughts to the conversation, should there be an age limit for elected officials? Where would you cap it? Our number is 888-477-9499. Our email is studio2@whyy.org.
And so, Maya, I wanted to bring you back into the conversation because, you know, you were very conservative in your age cap. You said 80. Why 80? Why not 75? Why not 65, like why did you choose that numerical cutoff?
So I'm not a medical and cognitive health specialist. I am an academic political scientist, but I do know, and others have argued for 80 for this reason, that studies tell us that a large number, by some studies, it's about half or so of people over the age of 80 suffer from some kind of cognitive impairment. You know, you started the segment by talking about the fact that we have over two dozen octogenarian members running for re-election. I might also point out that we had in late 2024 a member who was not in Congress at all because she was serving from a retirement facility, and it was reported that she had dementia issues. You know, to Dr. Gendron's earlier point about the job being unique and hard to measure, I certainly think that just being able to be in Congress, in DC, doing your job, being fit of mind is part of the job. And so historical examples, and to your point, regardless of age, but I think also inclusive of age-related health issues that have made it so that members, whether that be Senator Glass, Virginia Democrat from the 1940s, who was chairing the Senate Appropriations Committee and was largely absent from Congress in the 1940s because of his health, or more recent examples that you cited. I think that we need members that are fit to serve. If we don't have that, then we don't have constituencies that are actually being represented. And I do want to add just one more thing into the conversation, mm-hmm. if I might. Mm-hmm. That is the incumbency advantage. Mm-hmm. So I agree that we need to be electing people who can do the job, but it's not that simple in the current system. And when we have a system where there's an 85 to 90% win rate for incumbents, age limits also help us, you know, in addition to the things that we were talking about earlier, reckon with a system where there's so few openings for new politicians to penetrate. So I think that there is a wide array of benefits to age limits, and health is just one of them.
And Sue from Princeton says, I think term limits are the answer instead of age caps, but I'm not sure how long to make them. Would a term limit sort of solve the problem versus choosing some arbitrary age?
So I think the issue of term limits is a little bit more complicated. I would point to the fact that right now the average House member serves about 8 years or mm-hmm. four terms, and the average senator serves about 11 years or two terms. So the example of like Lindsey Graham, who was there for 30 years, those are not the norm. But I do think that those need to be taken into account, and there are folks who are in essentially safe seats for decades.
Yeah.
I think that term limits, you know, we can just take the example of what happened when Republicans instituted term limits for committee leadership in the 90s. What the term limits did there was that on the one hand, they opened up new opportunities for more Republicans to rise up and chair committees. On the other hand, they kind of drained committees of expertise to a certain extent when there was all of this turnover in staff and in leadership. So I think with term limits, we have to take into account that kind of delicate balance between the fact that you need to learn the job and you need to gain expertise. Yeah. And you should not be serving for four decades mm-hmm. in a seat or three decades in a seat.
Let's bring in a caller. This is Chuck from Philly on the line. Hey, Chuck, you're on Studio 2. We're talking about whether or not there should be age limits, term limits on serving on members of Congress and perhaps even the president. What are your thoughts, Chuck?
Yeah, I understand the concerns about needing to learn the job and getting that experience on the job. I do think that having term limits, it is a way of preventing people from serving sort of in perpetuity and having this problem without having a discrimination against an entire class of people. And I think the point's well taken that the average age might not, or the average length of service might not be that high, but I think we're really talking about the outliers in these cases anyway. So it would be one way, I think, of achieving that goal without telling a whole group of people, hey, you're too old to serve, or you're too old to even get into the scene now.
Hmm. Thanks for that comment. That was Chuck from Philly. Tracy, I want to bring you back in the conversation. Something I picked up on from what Maya was saying is that basically, you can't trust politicians to be transparent about their health problems. And as a result, you then need this blunt instrument like an age cap. I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but she brought up some examples from the past, and you could go even further back. Woodrow Wilson suffered a stroke and basically no one knew about it. Grover Cleveland had a secret surgery that was not disclosed to the public. I want you to contend with that a little bit. And this is a bit about what makes the job of a politician, elected leader, a little different, that there might be an incentive to conceal because they're in a position that's elected. And as a result, we then need to be more vigilant and we need to put an age cap in because we can just never trust them. I mean, your thoughts, Tracy?
Yeah, I think concealment is a huge problem. I mean, it's a transparency and governance problem. So the fact that people are holding on to office, as Dr. Kornberg was saying, when they're, you know, not able to physically be there or capacity-wise be there, is a problem. So there should be requirements for the job, again, that look at capacity and your ability to do the job. I have no argument about that whatsoever, nor do I that concealment is an issue. Mm. I just continue to come back to age is not the proxy to make that determination, or at least age is not the proxy in and of itself, right? And age is not the problem in and of itself. If we want more younger politicians to come in, we have to look at the system, leadership rotation, competitive elections. We choose a candidate pool long before election day, money, incumbency, party recruitment, professional networks. It's like there's so many elements that goes into who is eligible to be elected that we can look at rather than just making an age cutoff. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's bring in another caller. This is Greg from Norristown on the line. Hey, Greg, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment about this issue of age caps in Congress and the presidency?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very valid point. I do want to say that we do have term limits. They're called elections, right? Elections happen every 2 years. Yep. And I definitely recognize that there is a challenge with respect to incumbents having an advantage. But there are people that are breaking through. Look at Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, among others. Yep. And then when it comes to, I do think that the last speaker was very, very poignant in her comments. Age should not be the only factor. I mean, some of our most productive legislators have been older folks. Just look at Nancy Pelosi, one of the most effective, whether or not you agree with her politically, she's been one of the most effective members of Congress in the history of Congress. Some of our other ones, even ones that I disagree with, I mean, I'm not going to say their names on the air right now, but there are other people who have been effective. And when I say effective, they've championed policies and gotten policies accomplished. So I think that we've got to make sure that we have a broader spectrum. When we consider term limits, what happens is you move from having elected representatives run these institutions to then having staff members run these institutions.
Because they're the ones that stick around, right, Greg? They're the ones that essentially have incumbency.
Correct. You have the institutional knowledge. So do we want our institutions of government being run by staffers, by bureaucratic staffers, or do we want them run by elected representatives? So I think this is a multi-prong approach that we have to think about. Very fruitful conversation. But I do think, age should not be the only factor. There's mental suitability.
Yeah. And Greg, I have a quick follow-up for you, Greg. I mean, does your answer change when you take electability out? For example, judges or other people that are appointed by politicians, bureaucrats.
They're very powerful bureaucrats.
And there's no, the electorate doesn't weigh in on those.
Not directly, at least.
Yes. Yeah. Your thoughts on that?
I think you're 1,000% right. And in Pennsylvania, we've struck that balance in that we have judges that have to retire at age 75, right? I would also say that we're living longer. So right now, 75 is what we consider an appropriate age. In 10, 15, 20 years, if we've arbitrarily set this date or this age, it may be longer. We may, in 20 years, the average age may be 100, right? And so having it set not to an index is a problem. It's like our minimum wage, right? The minimum wage is $7 when it was set 20 something years ago. It hasn't been at a hasn't been indexed. So today that cost of living is substantially higher. But I think that we have to have that balance when it comes to elected versus non-elected. Yeah. And I think we have that right.
Thank you. That's Greg from Norristown. Great comments. We'd love to hear from you. Should there be an age limit for elected officials? Where would you cap it? 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. Carol from Langhorne called in to say, as an older citizen who lived through their 70s, no one in public office should be older than 70, whether they are the brightest people in the world or not. It's just ridiculous. John says, congressional age limits? Yes, please. Every geriatric politician has an office. full of millennial and Gen Z staffers that actually do the work anyway. You don't have to be old and experienced to govern. And he mentions that the average age of the Declaration of Independence signers was only 44. And so I'd love to get your take, Maya and Tracy. Does the calculation change when we're not talking about electeds? Because there are judges, there are other people who are appointed, and they're making major decisions, making rules. The voters don't get a chance to weigh in, and there's not a lot of transparency on whether they still have the capacity to do the work. Does your assessment change based on the position? And Tracy, I'll start with you.
You know, again, I'm just going to come back to competency for the job. And I think it's a really slippery slope and an important conversation to have. So, you know, where does it end? Should it be appointed positions? Should it be federal only? Should it be state positions? I'm a state employee. I should be held accountable as well. So, and I'm totally in favor of that and in favor of transparency. Again, it's just putting the systems and structures in place that look at the individual jobs, the individual responsibilities that come with those jobs, and then trying to figure out how we build a system of transparency and accountability within that.
Brian says, all good arguments so far, but at the end of the day, there's a vote. Should we focus more on voter participation and education? I mean, corruption aside, incumbents are reelected per the system. I want to put that to you, Maya Kornberg. Like, at the end of the day, if the problem is gerontocracy, if the problem is there's not enough new blood, new ideas in Congress, in the White House, why not go straight to the source and make it harder for incumbents to win re-election? Make other tweaks that would not require, you know, like Tracy said, just sort of throwing out a whole group of people based on an arbitrary cutoff. Isn't there a more precise tool we could use here, Maya?
So I certainly agree, and this kind of speaks to a few comments that were made earlier, that age limits are only part of the solution. I think that they are one of a package of things that we need in order to make sure that Congress is both descriptively representative and actually able to substantively represent the constituents that it is meant to serve. I certainly think that age limits have to be implemented alongside campaign finance reform if we want to actually fully handle the gerontocracy problem. We need to end Citizens United. We need to make it so that people from all walks of life and lived experiences in the United States, including Americans with less access to wealth, can penetrate the system and can run. We need to change the pipeline to running for office. I want a Congress that is, again, descriptively and substantively representative of the American public. And right now, because of the system and the way that it is designed, including the distortions of money and politics and the ways in which it's difficult to break in, that is not the case. I also think that when we have a Congress that is about a decade older than any other most other legislatures, at least in the world, from the statistics that I've seen, and we have a Congress that the average age in the Senate is in the 60s and the average age in the House is in the 50s, then we also have to think about, is that a Congress that is representative of the lived experiences and able to act on behalf of the broad swath of Americans that it is meant to represent? I think that we need a diversity of ages in Congress, just like we need a diversity of other kinds of demographic experiences. Mm. And right now, we don't have that. So yeah. Again, I think limits are part of the solution. And I think the advanced age of Congress is only part of the problem.
Well, we do have to end this part of the conversation here. And Dr. Tracy Gendron, chair of the Virginia Commonwealth University Department of Gerontology, we do have to say goodbye to you at this portion of the show. But thank you so much for your commentary today and your insights on Studio 2.
Thanks for having me.
And coming back on the other side of this break, we're going to shift the conversation a little to talk more about health transparency, not just age.
And our question is, should elected officials disclose medical issues that interfere with their job? And how do you balance a lawmaker's right to privacy and the public's right to representation? 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. That part two of our conversation is coming up after the break. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. This is Studio 2. And welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron. We've been talking about setting upper age limits for members of Congress, judges, the president, asking if that would make our government run better and be more representative. Let's do a slight pivot now to the issue of health transparency.
Yes, currently there are no requirements that lawmakers share personal medical information, but after a few cases of long unexplained absences, there's growing questions about what should and shouldn't be disclosed. Senator Mitch McConnell has been out over a month. We now know he was hospitalized after a fall, but information is still scarce.
New Jersey Congressman Tom Kaine Jr. was gone for 4 months without a word to his constituents. When he finally returned to the House floor, he explained he was being treated for depression.
Yeah, that leads us to our big question for the rest of the hour. Should elected officials disclose medical issues that interfere with their job? How do you balance a lawmaker's right to privacy and the public's right to representation? Give us a call, 888-477-9499, email studio2@whyy.org, and hello to our Facebook and YouTubers. You can leave your comments in the chat, and I'll reintroduce our guest. Maya Kornberg is a senior fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU Law and the author of Stuck: How Money, Media, and Violence Prevent Change in Congress.
And joining us now is Adam Gentleson, former chief of staff for U.S. Senator John Fetterman and the president of Searchlight Institute. Adam, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And so, Adam, you found yourself in one of the most difficult positions imaginable. You weren't simply a political advisor and chief of staff to your former boss, Senator John Fetterman. You were someone who believed a senator's health had become a matter of public concern. Can you take us back? And I want you to explain to us when you first believed that this had crossed the line from a private medical issue into something that needed to become public.
Yes. So with Senator Fetterman, you know, the precipitating health event for him was a pretty severe stroke that he suffered in May of 2022 when he was running for the Senate seat. At that time, I was sort of, you know, an advisor to his campaign, but didn't have a major role, but, you know, sort of observed it closely. And that was, you know, public. He was off the campaign trail for a while. When he came back, you know, the effects of the stroke were still very noticeable in his speech and his processing. You know, he went on to win that race. And actually, one of the things that was interesting about it was it seemed like the public generally was very sympathetic towards his ability to sort of keep going and get back out there on the campaign trail, even though he was clearly still suffering some severe effects. So initially, you had sort of a public validation of, you know, the people of Pennsylvania saying, we want this man to represent us, even though we are very aware of his health issues. You know, he somewhat famously, there was a debate between him and his opponent, Dr. Oz, where the results of the stroke were very evident. So, you know, this was not something that was lost on anybody who voted in that election, right? Everybody cast their vote knowing what the deal was with his health. Over the next few months, I was asked to be his chief of staff. And, you know, what I observed was that stroke sort of translating into extremely severe issues of depression to the point of where he would stop eating, he would stop drinking, he would go days, you know, where he was losing massive amounts of weight. He could barely concentrate. He couldn't, you know, really engage in conversation. Sort of bouts of extreme paranoia about, you know, literally stuff like, you know, people sort of coming, you know, people were going to come for him and take him away kind of stuff, to the point where I became convinced, and in close consultation with his family and the Senate physician, that he probably the best course of action was inpatient care for him. So in February of that year, after he had been seated.
This is now 2023.
Right. That's right. We're in 2023. You know, he got seated in January of 2023 to the Senate seat, you know, and just pretty clearly could not perform the job. He volunteered to go seek inpatient care at Walter Reed Medical Center and was there for about 6 weeks. When he was released, you know, his doctors testified to his ability to do the job, you know, but in a way that was sort of contingent on him sticking to a pretty strict recovery routine that involved everything from, you know, medication to sort of diet and sleep and all these other factors and you know, various forms of cognitive therapy. And, you know, what I observed was that he stopped sort of following the routine that was laid out for him. And a lot of the behaviors and tendencies that I'd observed when he was in sort of the depths of this depression started to show themselves again.
And you wrote a letter to his physician explaining all of this. And then later on, disclosed that letter to a reporter who you knew and was your friend. Can you tell us why you made that decision and what kind of crossed the line to where you thought, okay, I've told the doctor about this, but it has come to a place where his constituents need to know?
That's right. Yeah, this was a very difficult decision. You know, I'm not going to sit here and pretend that it was easy, you know, or that I don't still sort of struggle with it. But the key thing for me was that, you know, I believe that it had crossed over into a matter of public concern, and that the people of Pennsylvania had a right to know that this was going on and that this was the condition of the person who they were allowed on to serve them. I mean, a senator is an enormous job. You make decisions that affect people in every walk of their daily life. And I think that people have a right to know whether you're in the sufficient mental state to be able to make those decisions. You know, we were told by his doctors to sort of flag concerns if they, you know, met certain criteria, and they very clearly did. And so that's what I did. And I did think that public disclosure was the right move here. And the people of Pennsylvania can decide for themselves whether they think that information is relevant to his ability to continue to serve or not. But I thought my responsibility in that situation was to make that information public without, you know, violating his private, you know, health issues, you know, stating that I think that it rose to the level of affecting his ability to make judgment calls on their behalf was something they deserve to know.
So a lot of this came to light in a piece mm-hmm. that Sherry referenced in New York Magazine. Senator Fetterman at the time responded, called it a one source hit piece. I think the source being you, yep. and attributed all this to disgruntled staffers. Here he is talking to CBS Pittsburgh last year.
My doctors are like, John is great. And I am on all of the plan that it's always been. And it's incredibly invasive.
I want to settle on that last point, that him mm-hmm. saying it's invasive, mm-hmm. because I think you could make the argument that Senator Fetterman was maybe more transparent about his health problems than many politicians have been. I mean, when he had the stroke, he disclosed the stroke. Yeah. Yeah. When he went for sought treatment at Walter Reed, he disclosed that. It seemed like in a pretty timely manner. What is it that you think he did wrong or didn't disclose that he had some obligation to disclose?
I think that there's a lot he's not saying about what his, you know, the true nature of what his doctors are telling him, but that's, you know, that's going to be up for to him to decide to disclose or not. You know, the disclosure of his inpatient care was, I was involved in that decision, and I was in favor of it. It was somewhat forced by necessity. I mean, he was going to be away for sure. What turned out to be 6 weeks. So there wasn't, you know, I like to think it was the right decision, but I think, you know, either you do that or you get a situation like what you have with Mitch McConnell right now, where people are like, this guy's been away for over a month, what's going on? And then I think, you know, after that, it was sort of disclosure of only the positive and not the negative. And I think that's where we run into trouble, because I think that if he were to disclose, you know, all of the information that I think people are probably entitled to in this case, I think people probably look at it a little differently.
And I want to follow up, Adam. What do you think the public is entitled to in your mind? Because we're trying to figure that out right now. We've had multiple instances where elected officials did not disclose, were not available, questions not asked. Where do you think that line is? What is the public entitled to know in your mind?
To me, I think there's a couple categories, right? I think, first of all, if you have a medical condition that is going to keep you away from your job for an extended period of time, the public has a right to know what's going on, right? I mean, you are elected to serve the people of a state. You have a duty to, you know, be at work just like anybody else does. You know, you certainly have a right to take medical leave. But if it's going to be for, you know, a period of weeks, then you need to disclose what's happening, whether you're going to be able to return and when. You know, senators don't just pass laws that, you know, that are on the federal level. They perform extensive constituent services where people come to them with day-to-day concerns like, you know, immigration issues, or they need help getting passports, you know, or they're having a local dispute with local authorities that they need your help on. So all sorts of things that require you to be present and attentive to the people of your state, where if you're not there, you know, you're essentially delegating to staff, you know, who nobody elected to make these decisions. So I think it's very important, if you're going to be away for an extended period of time, to have some you know, real transparency disclosure. I also think that if there are things where you are physically in the office, but your cognition and your ability to make decisions has been affected, that is also a category where disclosure is required. So situations, you know, like Senator Fetterman's, or as we've seen with Senator Feinstein, where, you know, she would be at work a lot, but clearly had lost a lot, right, on a cognitive level, that's something people deserve to know as well.
And then the big question, right, is where is that line and how do we make mm-hmm. the judgment, right? Like, what do we mean by impacted cognition? You know, there's just so many ways to approach that question. Maya Kornberg bringing you back into the conversation. Mm-hmm. I guess moving away from just Senator Fetterman's specific case, but if we're trying to make a general rule about disclosure, like, what should that look like? Because my definition of intellectual fitness is probably going to be vary from yours. And so unless we can come to some scientific standard here, I don't know exactly how we would approach this problem. Do you have some guidelines for us, Maya?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, what I would want us to be cognizant of and keep in our minds in any kind of disclosure requirement is safety and privacy concerns that I think are increasingly important to respect. I've done a lot of work on political violence and the increasing violence faced by electeds at all level and increasingly their families, their spouses, their children. I have argued for the importance of address confidentiality for members of Congress and for others. And I think that anything that would potentially expose sensitive information about members, about their personal lives, their homes, their families, is something that we need to approach with a great amount of caution. I do think that in terms of what we should proactively have as a kind of threshold, a lot of the examples that we just gave are examples of people who just aren't in Congress. They're not in Washington, D.C. They're not able to do their jobs. And this is not new. I mean, one of the issues that that people might not remember when we think about the famous example of the caning of Senator
Charles Sumner.
Sumner, yeah. Yeah. Is that then he was largely absent from Congress for mm-hmm. 3 years because of his medical condition. So I think being able to show up and do your job is important. And I think that when it comes to public disclosure of your personal information, we need to be approaching that with great caution. And the last thing that I'll say about disclosure of any kind, you know, I have been a proactive advocate for banning congressional stock trading for quite some time. And one of the issues with any kind of disclosure, whether it be financial, whether it be health disclosures or anything in Congress, is that enforcement is very spotty and very lacking. So sure, I think that we need more disclosure. We need more transparency when it comes to finances and perhaps when it comes to health. But one of the reasons that I am a proponent of an age limit for members of Congress is that I don't have a lot of faith that internal structures right now in Congress are going to allow for any kind of disclosures to really be enforced.
Yeah. Adam, real quick, where do you think the line should be? Because I think someone might look at your testimony here and say, look, he made the wrong judgment call. Fetterman is still in Senate. Yeah, doing the job in some way. And ultimately, your determination that he was sort of careening down a path of self-destruction was wrong, and that it should never have been disclosed that there were these continuing issues. I mean, what do you think the line should look like where a senator should be forced to tell the public, I am having some sort of health problem?
Yeah.
I think, you know, it would be great for staff to not be put in that position. I think what would be optimal is if there was some sort of a, you know, sort of a public ombudsman from a medical perspective, right? Because, you know, what I heard was doctors saying things in private and then saying different things in public.
In public, right.
And so, you know, when you're in that position as a staffer and it's pretty clear to you that the public is being misled, that makes it very difficult. And that's the problem, is that those doctors' obligation is not to the public, it's to their patient.
Now, this assumes the person can remain independent in Washington, D.C., right?
Right, right. And so, right.
And did you feel like it was the staff's duty to do that? Because I wanted to piggyback on Avi's question as we get ready to wrap up. I mean, the line and then whose duty is it to hold the line? Because do you think it's staffers? Do you think it's the elected official? Like, who has that duty of disclosure?
This is where I lean towards transparency, because I think it's, we live in a democracy And, you know, I think without disclosing details, which I did not do, I disclosed my concerns. And I think the public is perfectly entitled to do with that information what they will. Mm-hmm. You know, we weren't releasing medical records, or weren't releasing names of medications or things like that. But I think that knowing that somebody who saw this person up close and personal every day had concerns on this level is relevant information to people who are going to decide whether they want this person to serve them or not. And they can decide that it's not important to them, or they can decide that it is. But yeah. I think that putting that information in the public sphere does become an obligation at a certain point when you sort of see things on the level that I witnessed.
Hmm. Well, that's Adam Gentleson, former chief of staff for U.S. Senator John Fetterman and the president of Searchlight Institute. Adam, fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for coming on today on Studio 2.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
And same to you, Maya Kornberg, senior fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU Law and author of Stuck, How Money, Media, and Violence Prevent Change in Congress. Maya, thanks for sticking with us the whole hour here on Studio 2.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, and I'm sorry to Michelle from Abington and Ray from Collegeville, callers that we did not get to. And thank you to everybody who wrote in. We got some great comments today. And of course, I got to say thank you to our producers, Debbie Builder, Hazel Mae Bryan, Paige Murray Bessler, and Ben Abrams. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Tina Calique and Diana Martinez engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We'll talk to you tomorrow.